About primordial magnetic fields, they're really interesting, mostly because of observational results in the last 4 or 5 years, and they're a little bit controversial, so I'll go over them. I'll start with trying to motivate this both from the observations and from theory, and then talk about how people have gone about trying to explain what they see. And to do that, they need to start out with some kind of primordial seed field. And then I'll talk a little bit about an inflation model, Bahr law inflation, that's based on a scalar field with an exponential potential energy density, and add to the usual inflation Lagrangian a coupling between electromagnetism and gravity, just the usual Maxwell coupling. And I guess this battery's probably dying, so maybe I'll just use this. And compute the magnetic field that's generated by quantum fluctuations in this model and show that it's really tiny on cosmological length scales. And then I'll talk about how to maybe modify this model to get a larger magnetic field and go through the computation of the quantum fluctuations during inflation and propagate them through the radiation in baryon-dominated epochs, and come up with some numbers, and then talk about future work and generalizations and some possible observational consequences. So most of this stuff is I did really long ago in 1992 in that APJ Letters, and there was a longer paper which got rejected, but if you're interested, you can find it on the webpage, my webpage at Kansas State. So that has many more details of the computation. Okay, so let me start with motivating this observationally. So what you do to measure these magnetic fields on galactic length scales, because they're so tiny, so the only technique you can use is the Faraday effect. So you look at polarized sources of electromagnetic radiation, and you observe them at multiple frequencies. And then if there's a magnetic field and charged particles along the line of sight, one polarization propagates faster than the other. And so if you start out, say, with linear polarization at some orientation, after a certain amount of propagation, the plane of polarization is rotated. And this rotation is frequency dependent. It depends on the frequency of the light you're looking at. So you can, with enough observations, extract the initial polarization, the final polarization which you measure, and if you make some models for the charged particle density along the line of sight, you can figure out the magnetic field along the line of sight. And from this, people have discovered in our galaxy, by looking at radiation from pulsars, there's a lot of them, that there's a uniform component of the magnetic field that's uniform over scales of 5 to 10 kiloparsecs, that's of the order of a few microgauss. And there's also a noise component that's much noisier. It's much more inhomogeneously distributed. And again, that component has a strength of a few microgauss. People have discovered this in external galaxies also by looking at background quasars that shine through them. And you see this in galactic clusters, maybe a little bit weaker, of the order of tenths of microgauss. And in the last decade or two, people have started looking at these damped Lyman alpha systems, some at pretty high redshift, and claiming that there are magnetic fields in there of microgauss strength. And if that's confirmed, that's going to be a really interesting result, because that tells you that these damped Lyman alpha systems, which people think are baby spiral galaxies, have magnetic fields of roughly the same strength as present spiral galaxies. So there's not been that much evolution of the magnetic field since redshift of 2 or 3. Oops. I guess the battery is probably dying in this. Uh-oh. So, I guess I'm going to have to figure out what to do here. So I just want to forward. And you want the file back?
Yeah.
Just gonna. Oh, there's two of them. Okay. You want to try this?
Yep.
Okay. Great.
Okay.
Thanks. Okay, so that's the situation as it was maybe 5 years ago. And so basically what one can look at is fields on much, much larger scales. And there's a bunch of ways of getting bounds on that, because if you're interested in primordial field, galactic fields are not the thing you really want to be measuring. So there's a number of ways of getting bounds on an intergalactic magnetic field. And typically you kind of look at bounds from bumps in the microwave background, because if there's going to be a bumpy magnetic field, it'll create bumps in the energy density, and that'll show up in the cesobels. And you can do this by getting bounds from nuclear synthesis, and there are other techniques for getting limits on an intergalactic magnetic field. And till about 5 years ago, the bound was that on scales of about a megaparsec, the intergalactic magnetic field was less than a few nanogauss. Very recently, in the last 4 or 5 years, starting out with this paper by Neronov and Vok in Science, where they looked at blazars, and they looked at the high-energy photons that were coming out of blazars, and there's some way of figuring out what these things should look like, the angular distribution. And they claim that they don't see the expected angular distribution in these high-energy photons, and that one possibility is that these high-energy photons propagate and interact with an intergalactic magnetic field and scatter, and they claim they can explain the observed distribution in the halos of these blazars if there's an intergalactic magnetic field bigger than about 10 to the minus 15 gauss on scales of a megaparsec. So that's kind of an extremely remarkable result. I mean, so they've got a lower bound that's of order 10 to the minus 15 gauss. It's also pretty controversial. A number of groups have done this, and initially they all agreed that it's somewhere between 10 to the minus 15 and maybe 10 to the minus 17 gauss on these scales. But then some plasma and MHD people have started looking at the propagation of these high-energy photons in the intergalactic space, and they claim there are instabilities that can explain this without the presence of a magnetic field. And right now, the situation's not clear. It seems to most people that I've talked to that they think there is a lower bound on an intergalactic magnetic field, but this is a really active area of research. So if there is a magnetic field out there between galaxies, it's almost certainly a consequence of something beyond the standard model in particle physics. Okay, so let me explain why we need a primordial seed field. So right now, if you go and compute the charge particle density or the ionization fraction after recombination, it's about 1 part in 10 to the 4. So the universe is a pretty good conductor. And in the limit of a perfect conductor, you can write down the MHD version of Maxwell's equations. And the one that's of interest to me here is this guy over here. That relates the time derivative of the magnetic field to space gradients of the magnetic field. And it's obvious from this that if you start out with a zero initial magnetic field, so if the right-hand side is initially zero, then at any later time, because the time derivative is zero, the magnetic field remains zero. So you've got to generate an initial seed field if you want to see how that seed field evolves at later times when the universe is a good conductor. And so there are many options, many ways of generating such a seed field. So one way is that it could have started out on pretty small scales, that we formed the galaxy first and then collapsed that into stars, and then maybe stars generate a magnetic field, and when they explode, because there's a lot of charged particles, the magnetic field in the star is driven out through the galaxy, and then the galaxy takes that field and it's rotating and it winds it up, and that's where the galactic magnetic field came from. So this is kind of the bottom-up approach. And you start from generating a field, say, in a nucleus of the galaxy or in stars. And it's going to typically be an extremely tiny field. And so you have to amplify it. And the model you have to use is what's known as the dynamo. So I'll come back to that in a little while. The other option is that the field was there before galaxies formed on really large scales. And you generated it in the early universe. And then as galaxies collapse, because there's a lot of charged particles, they're going to pull that magnetic field in and then amplify it, because the volume that the galaxy occupies now is smaller than it had originally. And so these are the two competing models. So let's look at what you need for them. So if you start out with this galactic collapse model and then wind it up in differential rotation, if you're talking about a spiral galaxy, then we need a magnetic field on the scale of a megaparsec before galaxies formed, that when you take it to the present epoch, it's somewhere around 10 to the minus 12 Gauss. Because this is a pretty poor amplifier, because galaxies haven't rotated that much, and when you compress them, there's not that much compression. It's maybe a factor of 10 to the 6 or so. So you don't amplify it a lot. If you use a dynamo, and I'll go through dynamo models in more detail in a second, there's basically no consistent model on galactic scales, but it's an exponential amplification model. This works for stars and planets, and so it amplifies things pretty efficiently, but galaxies haven't rotated that much. They maybe rotated 50 times in their lifetime, so you can work back from a few microgauss field now, and you need a field somewhere of order around 10 to the minus 20 Gauss on a megaparsec scale between galaxies. So you need a weaker field, because these are more efficient amplifiers, but it's not completely clear that they can work. I mean, one problem with them is that if these damped Lyman alpha systems have microgauss fields at a redshift of 2 and 3, there's not been any change in the magnetic field since then, and so the galaxies have hardly rotated at all by the time they've become damped Lyman alpha systems. Maybe they've rotated 5 or 10 times, and there's hardly any amplification in that process. So let's look at these models in a little more detail. So I'll start with the anisotropic protogalactic collapse and amplification model. So we have some pre-existing magnetic field, and you have a gas cloud, and that gas cloud compresses from a larger radius, some approximating as a sphere, to a smaller radius. And because it's got a bunch of charged particles that are pulled in gravitationally, and they're going to pull in the magnetic field, so you start out with a weak field, get a more a stronger field, and then you form a disk. If this is a slightly non-spherical gas cloud, it's tidally torqued, and you start rotating, and you end up into a disk, and then the disk rotates, and you get some amplification from that. So it's a two-stage process. You amplify through collapse, and then you amplify by winding up the disk. And depending on the orientation of the primordial magnetic field relative to the collapsing gas cloud, you can generate pretty much all the topologies that you see in the observed magnetic fields. So the disk is, by the time you end up in the disk, it's about 10 to the 6 times denser, and that's the volume compression, the magnetic field, because you're going to conserve flux. It goes like area, so it's going to be 2/3 of that, so you get a factor of 10 to the 4 in collapsing it down in volume. And then by winding it up, maybe you get another factor of 10 or so. So if we start out with a seed field of order 10 to the minus 12 Gauss on megaparsec scales where the galaxy comes from, you can end up with a few microgauss now. So the other model is the dynamo model, and this is the typical picture for a planetary or stellar dynamo. So you have some magnetic field, and you have a rotating gas cloud, and you start out with this field which is poloidal, so it's kind of like some kind of dipole, roughly. And because of the rotation, it's pulled around and you generate a toroidal field. And then when you have enough turbulence, you can have convective turbulence and you can pinch off parts of that toroidal field and feed back to generate some more of the poloidal field. So this is a nonlinear process, and there's a time scale associated with the rotation, and it amplifies it exponentially on that time scale. So if we've had maybe 30 or 40 rotations of the galaxy in its lifetime, you get an e to the 40, so that's a 10 to the 17 amplification. And so you could start out with a seed field of maybe 10 to the minus 23 Gauss if you apply this to galaxies. But there's, of course, going to be like a whole bunch of feedback and dissipation because of the turbulence. And in fact, a number of people have argued that what you end up generating is a very noisy small-scale field that's pretty strong that stops this process, and you don't generate a large-scale coherent field. So I think the jury's still out on whether this model works for galaxies, because you just don't have enough time for it to work, and especially if the damped Lyman alpha systems have pretty strong magnetic fields in them already to redshift of 2 or 3. So I want to spend a little time looking at what people have been doing. So Hoyle was the first guy who pointed out this issue of magnetic fields. Yeah.
When you do that estimate e to the 40, how accurately is that exponent?
I don't know if there could be a factor of 10, but I mean, people say for planetary systems, it's just the number of rotations. So it could be, maybe it's, I don't think it's a factor of 10, but.
So is it, would it be, if this was, if the exponent was a little bit larger than expected and it could generate the early damped Lyman alpha magnetic fields, would it then be a problem that they hadn't grown like much, much bigger by today?
Probably, yeah. I mean, because it depends on how seriously you take the damped Lyman alpha measurements. I mean, Wolf and collaborators have been claiming that they can see microgauss magnetic fields. And if that's typical, then there's not been any change from a redshift of 2 or 3 to now. So your process should have saturated by then. And it's not clear that a 5 microgauss magnetic field is strong enough to really saturate anything on those scales. Right, way back in the past, yeah. And I mean, it's kind of difficult. It's really difficult to do these numerical simulations. So as far as I know, people have just been doing this in two space dimensions. And then they've argued that for these galactic type parameters that you generate much more of the small scale field rather than the large scale field. But I'm not an expert in that area at all. So if there are any other questions, just feel free to ask them, please. It's probably better that way. Okay, so the first guy who tried to make magnetic fields, cosmological magnetic fields, was Harrison in the late 60s. And he started out with the obvious thing. He kind of postulated there was large-scale vorticity, and then you have charged particles, and there's going to be a differential drag. Because the electrons are coupled to the gammas, and you can generate an intergalactic magnetic field of maybe about 10 to the minus 23 Gauss. This could work with the dynamo. It's kind of near the lower end if you believe the dynamo can give you that 10 e to the 40 factor. Unfortunately, you don't generate vorticity in inflation models. So if you are tied to the inflation picture of the early universe, this is not going to work. In the 80s, people started looking at this in a little more detail, and the motivation there was at some point people thought maybe structure formation didn't work in the standard way in the cold dark matter model, and you needed seeds. And one possibility was strings, and one model of strings was superconducting cosmic strings, and for them to work, you needed a primordial magnetic field. And that's why people went back and started looking at these possibilities in the early 80s. So the QCD phase transition is going to generate a magnetic field of maybe about 10 to the minus 38 Gauss. So the problem is that the fields they generate, all the power is on really, really tiny scales. And when you scale it out to a megaparsec, there's hardly any power left. And the same thing's true if the electroweak transition is second order, and that's not the case. It would generate 10 to the minus 31 Gauss or so. So they're basically way too small. So the obvious way to think about this is think about maybe trying to generate something on really large scales, and the only mechanism we have for that is to do it very early on during inflation. And that's what motivated me to look at inflation as a possibility. So I want to quickly summarize inflation for the few people who are not familiar with it. So we start out by looking at how the universe evolves in time. So I've plotted up the scale factor here on a logarithmic scale. And I'm going to plot a bunch of length scales over here. So I'm going to ignore for a minute that the current universe is dark energy dominated. And I'll just stop in the matter-dominated epoch. So that's the present time over there. You can go back to equal matter and radiation energy densities, and then go back to the reheating epoch at the end of inflation. So I've plotted a bunch of length scales here. So basically, this is the Hubble law. So we kind of go along this axis, and if you have something that ends up as a galaxy at some point, it's moving away from us by following the Hubble expansion. And this is something that was even further, that ends up even further away. And I've also plotted here the Hubble radius. That's the length over which you can send a signal at the speed of light from when the universe is born. And that's in red. So in the matter-dominated epoch, this comes in as you go back in time. And it comes in a little bit faster because it goes like h squared goes like 1 over a to the fourth. Over here, h squared, the Hubble parameter squared, goes like 1 over a cubed. And so eventually, as you go back in time, when you're looking at a galaxy that's really far away from us now, early on, it was outside our Hubble radius. But you can go back further in time, and the Hubble radius is constant in the simplest inflation models where Q is zero. But in general, you can have Q less than 2, and you'd still get inflation. So you go back in time, the Hubble rate, the length scale comes back in, and it's at a really, really small length scale, so you worry about quantum mechanics and zero-point fluctuations here. And you've modified the vacuum because you have this background gravitational field, and so a little bit of that zero-point stuff is left over, just like in the Lamb shift of the Casimir effect. And that guy kind of goes out, gravity is unstable, and in principle it grows, and when it comes back into the horizon, it's big. I mean, that's how you generate density perturbations. So the way to model inflation is to use a scalar field. We start out with a really flat potential at the beginning. The scalar field rolls down here slowly, and the energy density of the scalar field has a kinetic energy part and a potential part. The pressure of the scalar field has a kinetic part, and it's the difference between the kinetic and potential energies. So if phi dot is small here, then these terms can be ignored relative to V, which is the height of the potential. And so you get rho going like V, the potential energy density, and P going like minus V. So basically, you have a cosmological constant. And when you plug it into energy conservation, you get a constant energy density, and you get the de Sitter solution. So if you have a flat potential, you get a de Sitter solution. But in general, you can have a potential that's exponential of minus square root of q over 2 times phi, the scalar field. And you get this power law expansion. So I'm going to take a more general case with this scalar field potential instead of just a flat potential, and look at quantum fluctuations over here, then let them fall down, the universe reheats, and you get the radiation-dominated epoch. So I said this already about fluctuations. So but basically, you modify the vacuum, and some of those zero-point fluctuations do what you want them to do. They generate the inhomogeneities you're looking for. And people have done this for energy density perturbations. So the action we're starting out with is the standard Einstein action with a scalar field, kinetic and spatial gradient term, and a potential energy density. And because I'm interested in generating magnetic fields, I mean, of course, we don't have electromagnetism back there, depending on what your standard model is. I mean, if it's just standard electroweak model, this would be hypercharged. If it's some gut model, it's some other abelian field or something that's embedded in something more complex. but I'll just put in the Maxwell equations. And obviously, flux is going to be conserved. You can work through this and solve this, but B is going to drop like 1 over A squared, or the energy in B, which is like radiation, goes like 1 over A to the fourth. And then it hits reheating, so you generate both B fluctuations and E fluctuations, but when you hit reheating, as the potential falls off down here, it oscillates, and if it's coupled to other fields, it's going to generate those fields, and eventually it'll freeze down here at the vacuum point. And because the charge field's there, your conductivity, which is zero during inflation because there are no charge fields around, it just shoots up, and then I'm going to model it by a step function. So at reheating, your electric field goes to zero because the conductivity switches on and you're left with a magnetic field, and you can do the computation, and the magnetic field power spectrum goes like K to the 1 over A to the fourth. And you put in the numbers, you find that on a scale of about a megaparsec, now at the present epoch, it's about 10 to the minus 59 Gauss. And this is not unexpected at all. So what you're seeing basically is that we have a conformally invariant model here, because there's a conformal symmetry, so you can scale everything, and you're basically looking at electromagnetic fluctuations in Minkowski spacetime, and those are insignificant. So you've got to do something to change things. You've got to break the conformal invariance. And there's a bunch of ways of breaking conformal invariance, but well, let's just look at this problem in a little more detailed way. So if I plot energy density against scale factor here in logarithmic units, on a logarithmic scale, so during inflation, you have a relatively flat energy density, maybe it drops a little bit, then the universe reheats, and you get the radiation epoch, you get matter dominance, and you get dark energy. And if we're looking at the magnetic field, what you're doing is you're generating fluctuations during inflation, and that drops much, much more steeply than the energy density in the cosmological constant or the scalar field during inflation. So if you want to get a large value of B now, I mean, you can think of this in two ways. You can think of this as translating it over here or just pushing it upwards. What you're going to find is that the universe is going to be dominated by magnetic field energy density during inflation, and you'll never get inflation. You won't have a flat enough potential energy density that overwhelms everything and acts like a cosmological constant. So your only hope to get a large enough magnetic field now is to somehow bend this energy density down, the magnetic field energy density down during inflation. And that's relatively easily accomplished. You can introduce a dilaton-like coupling to the inflaton. And then what happens is that if you can make this model somewhat, you choose your parameters so that it bends down over here. So you're in an effective medium where you have magnetic permittivity here, that instead of rho in T00 in the magnetic field just being B squared, it's B squared over mu, where mu goes like e to the minus alpha phi, where alpha is this coupling between, that tells you the strength of the coupling basically between, or the relation between the phi field and the vector potential. And then at the end of inflation, when you're sitting in the VEV, the scalar field freezes here, and you recover standard Maxwell electrodynamics, because this guy just becomes a constant. So that's all I'm going to try to do, and I'm going to look at quantum fluctuations in a model where the inflaton is also a dilaton and it's coupled to electromagnetism. So we look at right. It's got to be bigger, right? Because you want this to be really strongly coupled. So if you're dealing with an effective classical theory, it's not an issue. But if you want to try to deal with this quantum mechanically, it's a big problem. But in principle, you don't need any charged fields during inflation. You just have this neutral scalar field. And so there's nothing it couples to. Okay, so I'll just do this in a gauge-dependent way. I'm going to pick synchronous gauge for the gravity part and temporal gauge for the Maxwell, the dilaton Maxwell system. And so you get your kind of standard equation of motion for the vector potential, the second time derivative, the Hubble drag term, plus the term from the dilaton coupling, and the usual space gradient. So you just solve this. And during inflation, you pick your initial conditions in the standard way. You say that on small scales, when you conformally rescale everything, it's got to look like flat space-time. And that fixes the initial conditions. And then you can go and compute B. And basically, you find fairly complicated expressions. But when you compare it to what happens in the free electromagnetic case, where there's no coupling between the scalar field, in that case, B goes like 1 over A squared K to the half. You find, depending on the values of your parameters, the parameter Q for the potential driving inflation and the parameter alpha that couples the scalar field to the vector field, that you can shift power depending on what your combinations are for these parameters to the infrared. And that's what you're looking for. You're trying to generate large-scale power instead of having it all on small scales. And then you just look at the energy in the magnetic field, in the electromagnetic field during inflation. You've got to make sure that that does not overwhelm the energy in the scalar field, because if it did, then you have this huge back reaction and you have a problem, you don't get inflation. And you can work it out and it does work out fine. There's no problem, there's no back reaction problem. So then you just propagate this guy through the radiation and matter epochs. In the radiation epoch, you have charged particles. You introduce the conductivity. That's the new term in here. It's no longer a free thing, a free electromagnetic field. And you freeze the coupling to give you back your standard low energy coupling. And I'm going to make life simple. I'm going to assume the conductivity is infinite. So I just get rid of E right away. And I'll also ignore this last dark energy dominated epoch. And then we can work out the numbers and the various power spectra. So we get a power spectrum for the magnetic fluctuations that goes like K to the N hat, where N hat is between -3 and +2. And because we're dealing with standard electromagnetism in the late time universe, it goes like 1 over 8 to the 4, it's radiation. And if I choose, so you're going to generate scalar density perturbations too, and they're going to give you the bumps in the microwave background. And if I normalize the microwave background to Planck or WMAP, then I fixed everything except one parameter. So basically, then you get a whole possible range of magnetic field strengths, anywhere from 10 to the minus 65 Gauss to 10 to the minus 9 Gauss. And if we focus on the upper end of this, this corresponds to requiring that the density perturbations be scale invariant, and the magnetic field spectrum is also scale invariant. So scale invariant magnetic field power spectrum is K to the minus 3, so that's basically B going like R. And the magnitude is about 10 to the minus 9 Gauss. So close to this limit, where you get, you can make a prediction that you're gonna find a K to the minus 3 magnetic field spectrum and a strength of order 10 to the minus 9 or 10 to the minus 10 Gauss. And you probably don't want something that large even for the collapse and differential rotation scenario. And the energy density perturbations are consistent with the observations also. And it gives you a seed magnetic field that's big enough to explain galactic magnetic fields. Okay, so there's been a lot of work after this on extensions. So Bamba and Yokoyama did a really careful computation, and they basically confirmed these numbers. So people have generalized this. So instead of coupling, treating the inflaton as a dilaton, they've put in an extra scalar field, an inflaton and a dilaton-like one. So that works also. Dolgov has looked at another way of breaking conformal invariance and inflation by coupling it to using the anomaly. And he needs to get his large enough magnetic field, he needs many thousands of new particle species. So maybe that's not the really best option. You could also try a pseudoscalar coupling to an axion instead of just the standard scalar coupling to the inflaton. And over there, because the axion coupling, you can rewrite it as a derivative coupling. There's more, one extra k in there, so you get more power on small scales. So you can generate magnetic helicity on small scales. But it's not clear you can generate a large enough large-scale magnetic field in these models. And in a lot of dynamo models, people want magnetic helicity, so maybe there's also an axion coupling, but that's also not completely clear at this point. There are many other ways of trying to generate these magnetic fields, but I don't think anybody has come up with models that give you a big enough one. So you could try using a charge scalar field and just do scalar electrodynamics. And the models I've seen, the computations I've seen, don't give you a big enough magnetic field for this to act as a source for the collapse scenario for amplification. People haven't looked at putting in massive fermions and using that to describe the current. So that would be one interesting thing to explore. I mean, you've got to break conformal invariance, so that's why you introduce something to break it, and that's one option. There's been a lot of work on using non-Einsteinian gravity, and so that gives you many more options, but it's not clear that these non-Einstein gravity models are consistent with the rest of the cosmological observations, but you can get a big enough magnetic field in these models. Or you can do nonlinear electrodynamics, and again, there seems to be enough freedom there to give you big enough magnetic fields. So you do inflation with nonlinear electrodynamics or inflation with non-Einsteinian gravity. And people have looked at many, many other options. So I'm not going to go into all of that. So I think it's pretty clear that we're going to need a seed field and that these magnetic fields are important. And we're starting to see evidence for a new beyond the standard model phenomenon. So there's a whole bunch of inflation models that can work. And in the simplest case, you can make a prediction that you're going to see k to the minus 3 power spectrum in the B field or something close to that if you want a large enough magnetic field amplitude. So the issue is really how are we going to find these guys out there? And in the next 10 or 15 years, there's probably going to be enough sensitivity to find a magnetic field of maybe half a nanogauss or so on scales of megaparsec. So the most studied option is to look at the CMB is polarized, so if it propagates through a magnetic field, the magnetic fields of order a nanogauss or so on a megaparsec, you're probably going to see this rotation with the next generation of polarization satellites. You can get limits now from the bumps that are induced by the magnetic field energy density in both the CMB temperature and polarization anisotropies that have been measured. And they give you limits of order a nanogauss or so on a megaparsec scale. People have started looking at other consequences of these magnetic fields. One thing that people have studied quite a bit is to study how they affect the formation of the first bound structures, so the smallest objects that form first. And there's some slight changes that might be observable at some point. Very recently in this preprint, because of the effect these magnetic fields can have on the gas in during galaxy formation, they've argued that they're going to change the stellar mass function that are produced in galaxies when they form, and that might be observable too. So one really interesting possibility is if you generate these guys during inflation, they're homogeneous across the whole universe. The observable part of the universe is isotropic and homogeneous because it's been stretched so much. And so you basically you pick a direction that breaks isotropy, even though it breaks it in a very, very tiny way because the magnetic field energy density is so low. It gives you a preferred direction. And people have been arguing that some of the WMAP and Planck anomalies in the microwave background on really large scales can be accommodated in models where you weakly break spatial isotropy. And so models like this are of interest to try to maybe explain those anomalies. I mean, nobody's found a model of magnetic field that works to explain them, but it's an area that's worth exploring. Okay, so there's a whole bunch of open questions. As Latham was pointing out, if you want a magnetic field this large, the model has to be strongly coupled during inflation, and that's not an issue as long as you're dealing with a classical model and there's no charged particles during inflation. If you want to try to quantize this, and you have to quantize it at some point, that's a big issue, and it's not clear to me how to resolve that. It could be that there's some more fundamental model that can explain this, and that's an area that people are exploring now. I didn't account for the last dark energy-dominated epoch. I didn't really treat reheating that accurately. I didn't deal with the electroweak phase transition because, I mean, even if you just assume it's a standard electroweak model, there's going to be a change in the amplitude as you go through this transition. So there's a whole bunch of interesting things left to do, and the observations are the real interesting area. So I think I'll just stop here and take any questions.
So in the weak strong coupling issue in the previous slide,
yeah,
is that only an issue if there's charged particles, or would it be a problem if all you had was the gauge field and no charged particles? Plus,
I don't think it's a problem just for the gauge field and the inflaton, because I mean you can solve it's a classical theory and you can solve the equations. There's nothing nonlinear. You can do everything. So it's the coupling. So the coupling thing in front of the F mu nu term, F mu nu, is really the coupling between charged particles and electromagnetism. So if you don't have that term in the Lagrangian, you're not going to generate them.
If you had the charged particles and it's strongly coupled, can you think of that as being, you know, a weakly coupled electric field with, you know,
It could be. I haven't thought about that, so maybe that's something interesting to think about. I'm not sure.
There's no known experiment that disagrees with Maxwell's equations.
That's right.
In particular, fiber fringes is not predicted by Maxwell.
No, it is.
Well, very small effect.
I mean, it depends on the density of charged particles in the magnetic field, right? I mean, that's observed. I mean, that's seen in the lab. I mean, even in solids. I don't know about nonlinear electrodynamics, but I mean, just birefringence, I mean, it's well studied in the lab. I mean, you can do this in gases. You can do this in solids. I mean, that's one way you check stresses in solids.
Effort you put into detecting birefringence cosmologically.
Right, right.
And no one has seen it.
The people have seen it astrophysically. They've seen it in our galaxy, they've seen it in other galaxies, but they have not seen it in intergalactic space. So you can see this with pulsars in our galaxy. That's how we study the magnetic field in our galaxy.
Incredibly small magnetic fields.
Yeah.
The mass magnetic fields, the sun is a few Gauss.
I know.
So this is so small.
It's just amazing. I mean, for people to claim that they're getting low limits of 10 to the minus 15 Gauss, I
begin to wonder what it means.
Yeah. I mean, it's amazing.
I wonder if, I wish he was here, he just left.
I've talked to him.
Okay, yeah. I'm not sure I can give a proper account of what the new constraints.
So he's doing the quantum mechanics. So he just kind of said, let's do the quantum mechanics of this and look at the Schwinger mechanism during inflation.
Yeah.
And so it's you're going to generate charged particles. And I mean, so you can't really do quantum mechanics with something that's strongly coupled like this unless you have some technique for dealing with it.
Mm-hmm.